Thank you for tuning in to the Head Game Podcast, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, where you grab an inside look into the heads and minds of the high performer. Learn what they do and how they think to help you take control of your own head game.
On the Head Game Podcast today, we have Jonathan Bittner. He is a former U.S. Army sergeant looking to take his experience from deployment and share that experience to help others. He is the founder of Chestnut Hill Therapy Collective, LLC, where he supports and provides therapy to those who are recovering. His perspective on the head game really shared insight into how the USA military deal with PTSD both on deployment and when you come home. On his available time, Jonathan reviews fragrances on his Instagram. In addition, he shares his story about how he recovered from some traumatic challenges and how he continues to move forward. Welcome to the show, Jonathan Bittner.
So, Jonathan, tell us, how do you go from the military to fragrances? How does that journey unfold for you?
So that's a very good question. It's actually not something that I really came up with an answer to until many years later, actually pretty recently. So the military for me was mostly an amazing time. What wasn't a good time was my deployment to Afghanistan. Part of me actually thinks it was, mostly a good time, and then there's a lot of bad intertwined with that. So a lot of loss, trauma involved with that. And then fragrances was a way for me where it was a way that I relaxed. I enjoyed smell, creating new happy memories that were associated with different fragrances. And so in a way, it's like fragrances help build, new pathways in my brain and help reinstate or instill positive memories of different things that I've done since the trauma that I've experienced. So it kind of turned out as something that I enjoyed, but then there was a lot more meaning into it as the years went on, and I became to understand why I gravitated towards different fragrances or gravitated towards certain times a year, liking to wear certain things or to talk about different fragrances. So I would say that's really why, I really got into fragrances after the military. I know it's a very kind of a weird thing to be in for a lot of people, but it's something that I'm very passionate about.
Did you get introduced to them? Like, or was that just something that you were always a part of and then you realized this is something that's supporting you? Like, how did you get into it?
So I started out, my earliest memory of fragrances or perfumes was with my mom. I remember on her dresser top growing up, she had a couple perfumes, and I remember just going in there and smelling them. I have no idea what they were looking back at it now. That was kind of the earliest time in high school. I was probably just like everybody else, or maybe junior high, where all the guys would come in and say, oh, look at this fragrance that my mom bought. It was like Curve or something similar to that. I just had to have it. And I remember it's just, I wore one fragrance for many years. And it wasn't until, again, after that deployment, after the war, where I discovered that there was a lot more to fragrances that I wasn't aware of. And then that sent me on a journey to kind of dig into that a little bit more and discover what else is out there.
Jonathan, you talked about, helping you sort of develop new pathways. You talked about loss and trauma, which we're going to, with your comfort, we're going to revisit in a little bit later in the show. Talk to us a little bit, though, about you sort of making that connection now. So often with persons in general, when they're trying to enhance their performance or they're trying to make particular changes in their life, it's all about creating new pathways. It's creating new habits. It's creating new behaviors. When did you make that connection between fragrances and pathways and the benefits?
So when was, I would say maybe about 3-4 years ago, when I met my wife. She's a mental health therapist just like myself, and she's really the one who said, I think this is why you're doing this. for me, it was just a behavior that I thought, you know, oh, this is just who I am, or this is just something that I did. But at that point, it became for her was like, I think there's something more in here that you need to explore. And I did that. And because of her help and her kind of pushing, I was like, okay, this really makes sense. Looking back at what I've gone through in my life and why I enjoy certain things. So that was a very impactful and important time in my life when she kind of nudged me in that direction to explore that more.
So Jonathan, you know, I think when you mentioned earlier, you know, with your deployment or your military time, take us back through why you first joined. What's your story behind that? Taking us all the way up to your deployment to Afghanistan, I think it was in 2008.
Yeah, so I grew up, you know, like a what I would call a normal, even though there really isn't such thing as normal, a normal household. At least for me, that's what I thought was normal. I, you know, both my parents were together. I have four siblings, three brothers and one sister. When I went through school, really, I had no motivation to do education or to do schoolwork. My dad had been in the military during the late 60s, during Vietnam. I had two uncles that were in Vietnam. I had great uncles in Korea, a great grandfather in World War I. So there's a lot of family history of military service in my family. It didn't take me long when I was in school to realize that, well, academics, or I thought academics weren't for me. So the next best choice was to go into the military. A lot of it was to do with, you know, that family history of military service. But September 11th really kind of thrusted me further in that direction. Just seeing what had all happened and taken place that day, I wanted to do something to give back. I was in eighth grade at the time of September 11th. And that really was ingrained in my mind and really pushed me, you know, those years later to enlist and to go through that. So I deployed in, technically it was like December of 2007. So December 3rd, I believe it was. And, you know, right before Christmas. And ended up in Afghanistan a couple months after that.
I was just going to say, just, you know, if you could just let us peer in for a moment as to what that transition was like for you. So often, Jonathan, you know, those who do not engage in the military, we as civilians, we're kind of on the outside looking in. What we see is very encapsulated by mass media. Right. And we don't really have that thorough understanding of what that preparation is like, what those challenges look like. So if you could just kind of walk us through some of those early experiences, perhaps in your training, ramping you up to deployment, and then maybe even some of what that experience was like for you.
Probably the easiest way to explain this is I don't believe that any civilian, if you took them off the street, would be able to transition into combat easily. There has to be a mind shift that takes place. And in all the branches of the military, we like to talk trash. You know, each service, like the Army likes to talk trash on Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, vice versa too. But each of these branches really mold people. They take a civilian off the street, oftentimes somebody who's just graduating high school. They come from all different walks of life, and now you have to create something that follows orders the first time they're given. In a way, they have to become desensitized towards, you know, violence, you know, try to desensitize people towards trauma that may be experienced. So when that happens in boot camp or basic training, depending on what your service is, they call that period. But during that time, it's they strip out most of the civilian piece of you, and then they build you back into something else that they want you to be. So somebody who, again, follows orders, you may have grown up in a household or an environment where you didn't listen to authority. So they strip you down from that, build you back up, mold you, and shape you into who they want you to be. And so that's often a long and tedious process, a very hard process, a lot of mass punishments. So if one individual messes up, you know, the whole platoon or the whole unit will get some kind of, you know, PT training. So whether it's push-ups or front back O's, bear crawls, whatever it is. And so they're instilling new values that maybe you didn't have before. They're instilling new habits, new routines in your life, and again, creating you into what they want you to be as a military member. So you take that, and then you deploy that person to a combat zone. There is some fear associated with that, you know, going into war for the first time, not knowing what you're going to experience. But it's a lot easier to shift from, all right, you've been through training, now you're in a combat zone. That's easier. That shift is easier rather than just taking somebody off the street as a civilian and then putting them in combat.
What's going through your mind? You get all that training that to kind of prime you for that experience. You know, what was it like for you to kind of have that head game switch, you know, knowing that you're going to be deployed and then actually being deployed?
So it's different. Like I wish I could sit here and say I recognized what happened. I wish I could sit here and say that I recognize and was aware of that shift. You know, being 18 years old, 19 years old, my brain wasn't fully developed to really understand. There was a shift that happened. During those times, I just thought, well, everybody else changed, I'm still the same. In reality, looking back at it, there was that major shift. Like, I'm able to see that clearly now. So when I was getting ready to deploy, it's like my thought process was different. I wasn't really afraid of deploying. I wasn't afraid of going to war. That being said, once I got there, some things were different. But just leading up to that event, you know, looking back, it's like I can see that how that shift took place and the effects of it that it had on me. But during that time, I had no idea. Just thought that I was trained. But there was a lot more that took place that I'm still, you know, uncovering.
Jonathan, you know, in one of the things that we do with our athletes, with our high performers, is we try to introduce them to what we refer to as more of chaotic elements. So our point of difference is really trying to train people in the mental fitness arena with skills that are required while they're in a heightened state of arousal versus the calm retreat, at times even escape from stress model, which has become very popular, especially since post-COVID. Talk to us a little bit about your own grind going into combat, experiencing a level of chaos that I'm assuming up until that point in your life, you'd yet to experience, and then share with us, what are some of the things that you now, when looking back, recognized were parts of you that were really strained, tested through that?
So, you know, to answer this question fully again, I'm going to, you know, take a step back into the basic training. And that's where I was really introduced to that chaos model. You know, you have people constantly yelling at you, constantly really treating you like a child. Be here at this time, do this, go to bed at this time, make sure your bed's made this way, specifically this way. If not, there's going to be chaos. So that's where I became comfortable in operating in chaos, because there was that mind shift. And that's something that you can train people in, is, you know, again, like you were talking about, introducing chaos to somebody to see how they can succeed. The military was excellent with that. And so you take that, you know, the basic training aspect, that what they can introduce in terms of chaos, you send somebody or you send me overseas to the war, where the chaos is amplified. You know, when we think of chaos, we often just think about a million times of things going on at one time, right? Especially when you think of war. You know, chaos can be, you know, bombs going off, bullets, you know, coming over your head, explosions, things like that. And yes, that is part of chaos. But it's interesting, chaos can also be, you know, the quiet times in war. And so some of the scarier times for a lot of people was when there was a lull in combat, where you're sitting there with yourself and it's quiet and you're expecting something to happen. And that happens because you are introduced to chaos. You know, you become comfortable operating in chaos. You actually become very successful when, you know, when things are hitting the fan, when, you know, everybody's running around, when everybody has this job to do. Amplify that in the military on deployment. You're working 7 days a week, oftentimes 12, 15, sometimes up to 48, 72 hours at a time. Sometimes you're not sleeping for a couple days. That creates a different form of chaos. Of now you're fighting sleep. Now you're fighting, you know, the elements where it's really hot. You're fighting your body. Am I getting enough nutrition? Am I getting enough hydration? You know, temperatures 130 degrees, 100% humidity. So chaos, again, oftentimes people just think of a million things going on at one time, but it also can be, you know, the elements that also create a form of chaos.
Did you feel prepared for that?
I don't think you can ever prepare somebody for that. The interesting thing is when people go to combat, when soldiers, men and women go to combat, you can't 100% fully prepare them for that. But that shift happens during those months or those years that they're deployed. And unfortunately, the hard part is once that shift happens, you can't undo it overnight. There's no magic pill. There's no snap of the finger that, you know, when that soldier, airman, marine, or Navy, or the sailor comes home, there's no way to just snap your fingers and then undo, you know, that ability to be able to thrive in chaos. So that's kind of an issue oftentimes on its own, where, you know, I think it may be more specific to veterans and maybe law enforcement or first responders, where it's like you introduce this chaos, but then it's just like, and they thrive in that. But then how do you teach somebody that this isn't again, I'm going to use that word normal, but it's not a normal type of chaos that you're going to experience outside of a specific environment like that.
Yeah, the state can be necessary when you're in the midst of the performance, right, if you will, but then it's that recovery aspect. And regularly when we're working with high performers and something is coming up, something is building, you know, the anticipation or the natural activation of our bodies, right, fight flight system amplifies. And that actually is important, right? It allows us to perform at a higher level, right? Get the adrenaline that we need to perform. But sometimes there's been a lot of research on athletes especially, and they'll get themselves in a nice amped up position, amplifying that sympathetic system, that fight flight system, but it'll take them more than 24 hours to actually fully come down from it because their body is hardwired from it. So even after that last whistle blows, right, you're still in that state. And it sounds very similar to what you're saying is you get into this natural heightened sense and state, but then there's never really this come down. There's not I don't know if there's a protocol or anything like that, but that didn't seem like, you know, that they weren't supporting it or whatever it might've been, or even knowledge of, you know, how to come down from that. Is that accurate?
I would say yes to an extent. And I'm actually getting kind of excited hearing you talk about how you introduce this, that stress and chaos to athletes, because like my mind automatically went back to, you know, my time deployed. And I think one big aspect of this, of deployment, is the trauma. So when you introduce a lot of trauma into that scenario, it's our brains tend to get stuck. And so regardless of how you, you know, you kind of try to bring somebody down, if that trauma piece is there, like some soldiers, veterans deal with severe trauma. And I think that may be the biggest piece. So the military, when you come back from deployment, you sit through many hours of, we call it death by PowerPoint. So PowerPoint slides after PowerPoint slides, talking about mental health, talking about, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, talking about alcohol abuse, drug abuse. But at that point, you just want to go home so bad that you're kind of checked out of these presentations. You're tired, you're bored, like nobody at that point, like looking back at my own experience, I didn't care about, you know, mental health. Oh, this doesn't affect me. And the other piece of this is I never realized that I had changed. And so looking at these PowerPoint slides about mental health and what you could experience coming from a chaotic environment like that, I said, well, I'm not affected. So this trauma, or I didn't even know it was trauma at the time, these events didn't affect me. So I thought, I'm still the same person who I was before. So this isn't relevant information to me. So that's coming from a 21-year-old. Looking back, it's like, it kind of makes me cringe in a way, just because I know things are different now. And just looking back at that, I wish I could just slap myself on the side of the head and say, listen, like, this is relevant. This is important. And you changed. Like, trauma, and I think it's, again, like I said earlier, that trauma piece, I think, is what's really different. So you introduce somebody to thrive in chaos. You introduce trauma, some really severe trauma, and then, you know, put them in that heightened state. But then you don't teach them or train them to switch that off or how to deal with it. And so for a year, 365 days, that's kind of the hard piece where it just, again, there's no training to bring somebody down from that.
Jonathan, there's areas of, you know, your history when you share with us, and you kind of, there's so many different avenues and questions that I want to ask that I can take the conversation. But you're discussing now this coupling between the preparedness of going off to combat for deployment coupled with trauma. So it's chaos and trauma are coming together, but yet it doesn't seem as if there wasn't much support in what we would call more of that traditional mental peace all along the way. But your death by PowerPoint is upon return or on the precipice of your transition. With hindsight being clearer for you, if you could go back and perhaps tap yourself on the shoulder or ask the right questions of a superior officer, what type of help would you ask for? What do you think would be more appropriate to suit some of your needs as you were going through it to assist with transition?
Probably one of the biggest things that I would have done was if I could go back and tap myself on the shoulder, I would advocate for myself. To say, look, you know, be honest about the experiences that you went through. You know, to say you need to start talking about some of this stuff. So I lost several friends on that deployment. You know, I would be like, you need to open up and talk about losing your best friend. Another one of your very good friends, you know, losing them and to suicide on that deployment. Things like that, where I would just tell myself, like, these aren't things that everybody experiences. This isn't supposed, again, it's not supposed to be, you know, quote unquote, normal, you know, to experience loss and death on that capacity at that age. And I would say, you know, you really need to start digging into this stuff and talking about what does these losses mean to you now? Because the longer that you're going to go, without dealing with this and without facing this, the harder it is that it's going to be to open up those can of worms again. So that's probably one of the biggest things that I would tell myself is, number one, advocate for yourself. Number two, try to understand as soon as possible what those losses mean and how you can start dealing with that.
Jonathan, we train our athletes, our high performers, to build, develop mental capacity, right? When there's demands that are associated with any given task on the level of severity spectrum, our ability to engage in those skill sets, to grow our capacity, is the ultimate goal. Thinking of what you do now, you're in the mental health industry. Talk to us a little bit about your role, how you've continued to expand your own capacity to enhance your own level of mental fitness, albeit after your deployment, to really get you to that next level for your personal craft.
And so to answer that question, like I just didn't become this person who was involved so much into this over the years. It really took years of treatment at the Coatesville VA hospital in Pennsylvania for me to get to a point where I was comfortable and was able to work through that trauma. Fast forward several years or many years since then, you know, I'm a therapist now, mental health therapist. I have my own private practice. I sit on a advisory board for, you know, suicidality, PTSD, brain injuries through a University of Pennsylvania. I'm a full-time doctoral student working on my Doctor of Psychology degree. I'm a husband. I have, a fragrance review situation going on Instagram. And there's other things that I'm involved with. And so I'm in a place now where it's like thriving in chaos, thriving with a lot of things that are going on. And so that's where I'm at now. You know, I took all my experiences that I've been through, it molded me into somebody who can now deal with a lot more than one situation going on. So I really do have a lot going on, and it's amazing to be able to thrive through all of that.
We regularly talk about when your first mountain is Everest and then your next mountain is any other mountain, it seems less daunting. It seems less challenging. It's because of the lessons that you've learned by climbing Everest, right, that the ones become a little bit more manageable. And I think, you know, you're talking about this growth and experience of having to go through multiple stints, right, in a VA a hospital, you know, going through the challenges and traumas that you experience, going on deployment, finding partnership, you know, all of that comes along with that experience. And we try to make mental analogous to physical because just more people, it's more visual, it's more digestible a lot of times. And, you know, we think about muscles and how they build and grow, and they have to go through micro traumas in order to grow. But really, the growing piece comes from the recovery of that, right? When you feed it good nutrition, right? When you rest and recover it and then strain it again, it's that balance between those two that is really going to allow it to grow the most. If there's significant trauma without that recovery, right, then it just is an atrophying muscle, right? It doesn't grow or it doesn't become where it needs to be. And, you know, you're talking about this experience and maybe there wasn't a direct path or line of sight for what your recovery looks like, but this is kind of what it sounds like. You went through these traumas, these multiple micro traumas that are also a large trauma as well, but now you're incorporating this recovery model into it to really build it stronger. And, you know, kudos to you of leaning back into alternative challenges within your own life.
I really like how you made that analogy. You know, you climb Mount Everest. If Mount Everest is the first mountain that you're ever going to climb, you know, what is every other mountain after that? And that's kind of the attitude or the mindset that I have is, all right, Afghanistan didn't kill me. So is what's going on in my life now, is it going to kill me? if no, then I can do this and I can be successful. I can take on whatever I need to take on because I know at the end of the day, I'm still going to be here. I'm still going to have that opportunity to keep moving forward. So I really like that analogy. And then also that piece, it's like, you know, just like you were talking about how you build muscle. It's like you need a rest. You need to, you know, rehab those muscles in order to get stronger. If you're put in an environment where it's like, you go to war, you come back and you don't have that kind of that rehab time, and then you continue doing your mission, it's like, it's actually doing more harm than it is good. And so it does take that extra time to focus on yourself, to work on yourself, to work through the things that you've experienced. And just like that muscle building, it's just, you know, it's like post-traumatic growth. Having that time to rehab that, you know, and then you become stronger because of that. So that's really what's going on.
Yeah, one doesn't really exist without the other. There's a duality to them, right? A yin and a yang in that philosophy. There's a balance that's natural that comes with that. And, you know, you mention normal and that there isn't one specific normal. I completely agree with that. But I believe in balance or trying to find your own specific balance, right? Everything has rhythms, everything has timing. And trying to find your timing, your rhythm, what works for you, right? Some people can work in a faster pace or a slower pace. But I think it's some people sometimes lean into, well, I need rest. And that's all they incorporate, right? It's, well, you still need that strain, right? To kind of balance that out. And I think that's really a big part of our model is how do you recognize that both pieces are necessary, not one or the other, right? If you just all strain, right, then you're not actually, the growth won't happen. If it's all rest, then the growth won't happen. It's actually when you have both. So how would you say, you know, you, living through these experiences, you know, what's the mental, the head game, you know, to play to try to find that balance, at least from your experience, from your perspective, you know, how do you find that balance in life?
And that's a very hard thing to do oftentimes. You know, I'm on the go all the time, involved in everything that I am. You know, in the therapy world, there's something, you know, a term called self-care, which I think a lot of people talk about. A lot of people say this is good, but not a whole lot of people actually follow through. So that's actually a piece of me. It's hard to make time for myself. That balance is so important because the more that you give out to somebody else, the less that there is for you to have and to hold on to. It's so easy to lose pieces of, at least for me, to lose pieces of myself. You know, here's a piece of me in my private practice and my business. Here's another piece of me as a student. Here's another piece of me as a veteran. Here's another piece of me on an advisory board somewhere. So it's so easy to kind of lose track of these pieces. But what I'm trying to do is incorporate to do things for myself. So whether it's taking some time off, whether it's a half hour, an hour out of my day to do, just do something that I enjoy. I guess this is where fragrances come in too, where it's just, I'm going to spend a couple hours at a perfume shop that my friend owns, right? And just spend time there just relaxing and talking about something that doesn't have to do with mental health, doesn't have to do with school, doesn't have to do with things that I get paid to do. So that balance is hard. It really is hard, but it's about discovering how to make it work. And you brought up a good point too, is sometimes that rest can often be times as an excuse. Well, I don't feel like doing anything today. And this is something that I struggle with. So I don't feel like doing this today. And then tomorrow comes around and I have that, well, I don't really feel like doing this. So that same activity that I was supposed to do yesterday ends up being a week later. And it's like, oh, well, I've been working really hard, you know, so I'm not going to do whatever I need to do. So that's kind of a piece too. It's still something that I struggle with, is not using rest. You know, again, rest is very important. You need to have it, but I think it can easily become an excuse not to do something.
Jonathan, I'm sitting here listening to you, and you know, I think really good conversation naturally evokes reflection, right? So I'm sitting here reflecting, and I'm listening to you talk about your experiences, and I just got to reflect on my own life. I'm presently teaching my teenage daughter how to drive, and of course, parallel parking is her worst case scenario. It makes her very stressed out, especially when there's other people in the car. And just a few days ago, she had a rough go of it, and she was very upset. And I'm hugging her, and I whisper in her ear, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger." And I'm sitting here listening to you talk, and you are actually in a work environment in Afghanistan where your work did kill people. And someone actually took their own life while they were on the job. And that's a really insanely stressful work environment that is an outlier of experience in today's world, that none of us that are not privy to the military, who are actually been deployed, can relate to. So my question for you is, you're a doctoral student, you're a clinician, you have your own business. For all the high performers out there that are listening, what is it about when you throw your hat back into that ring, as Hunter said earlier, and you reiterated, when you climb Everest first, what's the shift? How do you approach every day differently?
And that is a very, very good question. That's actually something that I struggled with for the longest time. And I'm going to answer this question how I interpreted your question. If not, I apologize. But what kind of came up for me when you were asking that question is, like, when you climbed Everest for the first time, or if that's what you do for the first time, and then what does everything else become? And for me, that was actually a question that I really struggled with. I ended up in school at Valley Forge Military College for half a semester, several years ago. And I had a professor there who was also a veteran, had been through combat, had been in Iraq. I believe he was in the Second Battle of Fallujah, which was a very bloody and a hard battle. So he had come through a lot. He had noticed that I was in his class. At that time, I had a service dog. Her name is Annie. She's retired now, but she was really a big piece of my life who helped me get through a lot of those darkest times. But one thing that he had said to me, and this sticks with me even to this day, was, we've already walked with giants in our life. We have to get to that point where we're going to be comfortable not walking with those giants ever again. And that, or that phrase or that statement really hit me, as simple as it sounds. It's like, you will never walk with giants again. And how I interpreted that, and kind of going back to your question, is if you walked Mount Everest, or you hiked that first mountain that you ever climbed, you know, what else compares to that? Nothing. And so you've already done the hardest thing. And just like my experiences in war and in combat is, you know, the people that I served with and the people that I lost, the friends that I've lost that are no longer here on this earth, they are the giants. I had that privilege and that opportunity to walk with them. I will never walk with them ever again because they're not here on this earth again. So what is your motivation to keep going? And so there's people who, you know, using that analogy of Mount Everest, right? They walk up that, they hike that the first time. And when they come down, one of the biggest questions that they're going to ask, and it's a question I asked after the war, is what is left? You know, I've already done, you know, I've already walked with those giants, just like those individuals that said, I already hiked Everest. What is left? And sometimes it's that discovery of what is still there that's important. So athletes who are at the height of their careers, right? You know, they have it, or what we think they have it all together. They're in that situation where they're walking with those giants. And sometimes that may feel like the hardest time in their lives, or their careers. But what's really hard is what's going to come next. What's going to happen when they're not walking with those giants anymore? And so it's like that can be a challenge that can be even greater than walking Everest. And that can be a challenge from my experience that is even greater than combat and going through that trauma. Is what gives me the ability to wake up every morning knowing that I'm not walking with those giants anymore.
As you were talking about your experience and then you led it into athletics, it's the exact same thing that I was kind of thinking about. I was thinking about that point of transition, right? When you are going kind of just, you know, full steam ahead, everything is at your fingertips, and then something changes, right? Whether that be your position, what you're doing, what you're trying to accomplish. I think injury does this a lot of times to people mentally and physically. When we have a mental or physical injury, that creates that shift where we've had everything externally in our peripheral. We're able to see the broad scope. We can see the future ahead. And then something shifts and it becomes all narrow. It becomes very internalized a lot of times. And it's hard to see what's next. And some people try to seek that out, you know, and try to find what's next. And they're constantly searching for that, trying to find that next thing. And sometimes that drives them to finding their new passions. And sometimes that can drain people. And again, it's about properly setting people up with that transition. And if not, everybody has either been aware of it, or we don't really always have the resources and tools to do so, right? To make that transition happen, I think becomes challenging. And especially you as a 20-something year old, right, trying to make that transition, not knowing what you don't know, is very difficult to go through. And there's going to be a lot of pain points for you because you don't know what you don't know.
And that's kind of the hard piece of there is then it becomes, well, what's my purpose? Ultimately, my military career ended just due to mental health issues and some physical injuries that I got while I was in the military. But then it's like my identity was wrapped up into that. My whole sense of purpose was wrapped up into that military career. And it was like figuring out, well, what comes next? And, you know, there are some comparisons between veterans and athletes. You know, they're two very different worlds with two very different experiences. But I think the similarities can be there, where, especially with athletes, it's like after that, right? The injury, you know, if they're not at the height of where they were, you know, physically, it's like then it can get into their identity or even their, well, what's my purpose? Like, I'm not who I was, you know, back when I was, you know, playing sports to the best of my ability. Now I'm injured. So who am I? You know, what's my purpose? Am I worth anything? Am I valuable? And so I think that's a question that people on both sides, whether they're athletes or veterans, it's like they can both ask themselves.
Keeping your mind fit is as important, in some cases, if even more important than keeping yourself physically fit. And here we are talking about your transition, or, you know, once you've walked with giants that you know you'll never do again, and having that mindset. What do you do presently to keep yourself sharp, to keep yourself mentally fit?
One way that I found that really helps with my mental fitness is exercise. I got into boxing a while back. That's a way that I can, you know, let off a lot of the stress, a lot of the frustrations that I have of whether it's running the business or the school piece of things. And another way that I keep myself sharp is education. Kind of see how much education I can get apart from my mandated required college courses that I have to take. Am I learning something about something that I'm not using in my everyday life? So it's like fragrances, again, it's like I kind of come back to that. It's like I'm learning about new companies, new brands, new fragrances. For me, it's like fragrances is kind of like an orchestra, right? Or, you know, you have the different aspects of a fragrance, like different notes that come together and create like a symphony So smell. So it's like, for me, that's how I kind of keep myself sharp, is learning about stuff that's not associated with school, with work. I'm also an adjunct college professor, and I also work for a crisis hotline for veterans. So those are even more things that I do, but I want to try to find things outside of what I do for work that can keep me sharp and for me to put my energy into.
You were saying, you know, from how you were doing different things, and something I wanted to make it analogous to is, you know, a lot in the physical world, but what you were doing is you cross-train your mind. You think about different things, whether that be your fragrances, whether that be learning, whether that be involving in different groups or advocacies or working on hotlines. Like, you're doing a bunch of different things in seemingly connected but also different spaces that really give you kind of a wider breadth of knowledge, right? And I think that's important and critical to not just completely compartmentalize and put yourself in one zone, but really to have that cross-functionalization, because you can pull from a variety of different elements. It keeps you stimulated, keeps you growing, keeps you learning. And I think that's critical. So you're doing this cross-training of your brain to kind of keep it mentally fit. I think that's a critical piece. And along with that, you know, I always like to get into little nuanced details sometimes when I hear of interesting things. You know, for our listeners, like, in terms of the fragrance world, what is something that the average or the casual person who's engaging in that might not know? What's a little tidbit or a piece of knowledge that, you know, if I'm looking at this shelf of, you know, fragrances, like, how do I make a decision? Like, I'm just like, it smells good, I think, or I know the brand name. Like, what are the nuances? Like, how do you know that something is good, or what is it for you that, you know, through your experience, have you learned, and maybe help our listenership?
So one of the things with that is that's actually a very, very good question. And it's about trying different things that you aren't familiar with. So if I talk to most men who wear fragrances, one of the things they're going to say is, oh, I've worn this since I was in high school. You know, that could have been 40 years ago. So it's interesting, because if you go to like any Macy's, you go to whatever fragrance stores are in the malls, you know, around Christmas time, leading up to Christmas or the holidays, what you're going to find is a lot of spouses are going in and saying, my husband or my boyfriend wears this. And this is what he's worn for the last 20 years, ever since he was a teenager. So the way to kind of figure out what you like is to get out of your comfort zone and just try different things. Whatever it is, just get your nose on it. Even if it's marketed towards women. So marketing is a huge piece of this. I believe fragrances are really genderless. So a man can wear anything, a woman can wear whatever they want, as long as you like the smell. Because really, it's about what you like, and don't be afraid to try things. So that's like a piece of advice that I would have for somebody. Is just go crazy, smell everything, because you may be surprised. And you'll never know unless you give it a shot.
So Jonathan, talk to us about, you know, you're in the therapeutic ring, you have your own practice, you're a doctoral student. Talk to us about projects that you're presently working on, you know, passion projects, things that are, you know, top of mind for you. What are you presently working on? Share with our audience some insights as to what's going on with your day-to-day right now.
So one of my biggest passion projects that I have right now revolves around a procedure called the stellate ganglion block, SGB for short. What that is, it's actually a very interesting procedure that's done where there's just a local anesthetic that's injected, and it coats the stellate ganglion nerves, which are in the neck. And so what they're finding out that does is it's like unplugging your computer and plugging it back in. So people who have experienced trauma, who have PTSD, what this procedure does, it really kind of resets the brain, and it takes away a lot of the physical and mental responses that are associated with like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression. This is actually a life-changing procedure for me. I struggle with panic attacks for years, ever since my deployment. What this has done for me, it's literally just taken away the panic attacks. It's taken away most of the anxiety. It's taken away a lot of the depression. So it's a procedure that's been done for literally decades for pain, but it's fairly new on the mental health side. They were finding out that this is life-changing for people with mental health issues. So my project right now is to spread awareness for that. And so, because it's a procedure that I've had done several times over the last couple of years, I've seen the effects that it has on me. So that's actually a passion project of mine, is just spreading the word, hosting events where doctors who do this procedure will talk about it. And kind of for the veteran community, this is big. People need to learn about it. There was an article released a couple weeks ago that 26 veterans a day end their lives. So 26 veterans a day. And for my belief is that if this procedure is more well known and veterans took the opportunity to do this, I think it could change their lives and that number would decrease. So that's a huge passion project of mine. The piece of this too, which is amazing, it's just a local anesthetic. So it's out of your body within 24 hours. It's not a medication that, you know, you have to take every day. It's a shot, you know, one shot in the neck and it changes lives. So again, that's my passion project that I'm focusing on right now. That's not necessarily related to work, even though it is. I work a lot with veterans, first responders. Doesn't necessarily have to do with school either. But this is something that I'm passionate about on the side, is making sure that veterans who have gone through what I've gone through know that there are options. Because I'm tired of seeing these statistics from the veteran community.
Absolutely. And say that name again, just so that our listeners can understand it.
So it's called a stellate ganglion block. So it just, again, you can look up SGB, Sierra Golf Bravo, on YouTube. There's videos about it. 60 Minutes had done something a couple of years back. But so it's an exciting new procedure. So my passion project is even letting other clinicians know about this option for when they're stuck with clients who just, you know, feel like they're stuck in the trauma, so that there are options for people.
Yeah, your story is fascinating. And I think it's really critical for people to hear that there are resources and tools out there and that you can find and navigate and experience, and it's a constant navigation throughout life, but you're a testament to that. How can people get in contact with you if they have follow-up questions, or if they want to follow you on Instagram with your fragrances? How would people follow up, or even your practice?
So my practice is the Chestnut Hill Therapy Collective. It's in Chestnut Hill, the neighborhood of Philadelphia. We have a website, ChestnutHillTherapyCollective.com. On Instagram, my name is JBitFragrance_reviews. They can get in contact with me that way. Our website has my office number on there too. They can reach out. It also has my email address. People can email me, call me, whatever they need, or follow me on Instagram and shoot me a message on there.
Jonathan, I just want to personally, you know, thank you, aside from taking out the time, is that, you know, your transparency about your journey and your experiences, I think, is a very integral piece for the veteran in today's world. Some of the statistics that you share are staggering. But again, if it's not being talked about, especially if it's not being owned by the very persons that belong to that small collective, I think that the outside influence can only go so far. So I think the message that you share is a vital one. Thanks so much for taking time to share your own head game with us And I just welcome any and all others that, like yourself, that have a passion to follow it, that have a search for answers, to certainly pursue it. And I think that you really are a fine example to follow. So kudos to you. And again, thanks so much for, you know, your time today.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it. And I just want to say one thing is I almost became a statistic. And so it's just, that's why I loved sharing my story, because I've been there. You know, I've come close to being a statistic in my life, and there is hope. And so that's why I talk about this, is that there's hope. If I can do it, anybody else can. So that's why it's important to share stories, to let other people know that they aren't alone.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.